In after Zip and are we on?
Yeah.
The other thing, Jim, of well, there are a couple of points of interest, I think, in the operation. The 1st Canadian Division and 5th Armoured Division had this job of the big swing to the right. And it was interesting, Bert Hofmeister's headquarters, 5th Canadian Armoured Division, you were asking about the location of headquarters, just where they would be. Well, one night, in this very confused fighting that was going on, you see, the Germans were behind us, trying to get into Holland, back into Holland, and they were in front of us, defending Holland, and it was a period of really great confusion. And one night, Bert Hofmeister parked his headquarters in a little village called Otterloo. It could have been Waterloo in reverse, but it was Otterloo. And at about 12 o'clock, his division had done fairly well. And Bert was planning to move about 5 in the morning up, really to join them on this tremendous swing. And at about midnight, or 1 or 2 o'clock, I guess, 1 or 2 o'clock, suddenly his headquarters was attacked by about 1,600 frenzied Boche who were trying to get not back to Germany. They were trying to get back into Holland, into the Fortress Holland, as they called it, to help defend it against us. And, of course, they had about 2 miles of country that we occupied to go through. And, unfortunately, they hit Bert Hofmeister and his headquarters at about 1 or 2 in the morning. Now, Bert Hofmeister could tell you the story because he was there. I wasn't. I heard it next day from him, but there were these troops trying to swarm through, and a headquarters is really not an organization that defends itself normally. You know, you expect somebody else to do that for you. However, everybody pulled out their pistols and they shot in all directions, and I think finally they were saved by the Irish regiment of Canada. The Toronto unit had its flame-throwing carriers close by, and I think they saved the part of the situation by going up the road, firing flame, which they could do about 100 yards ahead, and these carriers went up the road and as fast as they could go, just burning to death everybody within sort of 20 yards of the road. This kind of stopped the surge that was coming towards Bert's headquarters. And the other thing I think that saved them possibly, apart from their own movement, was some British tanks that had what they call bombard. And they were a tremendously heavy mortar round, a heavy shell that they could fire a short distance and it had a shattering explosion. And I think they fired a few of these in support of Bert's headquarters. But come the dawn, he was still alive, and so were a great many people on the headquarters, and there was no problem. But it could have been a real disaster if it hadn't been, maybe, for the activities of these other... And it would have been a hell of a thing if at that stage in the war, with only about another 2 or 3 weeks to go, if we'd lost Bert Hofmeister and the whole of the headquarters. Finally, however, the surrender came, and of course the feeding of the Dutch people was the primary element. That took precedence over German prisoners, German anything. And so before the official surrender of the German forces, we obliged them to admit our trucks. But first of all, to admit several hundred British bombers came over and dumped food. They flew over into about 1,000 feet with bales and bales of food, and they dropped them in selected areas so that the Dutch resistance forces, who controlled the Netherlands then, could distribute the food properly. And this helped. About every day, say, 3,000 or 4,000 tons was dropped of food. And in addition, we would take in probably 500 trucks with another 2,000 to 3,000 tons of food through the German lines, occupied entirely by the Germans. There were no Canadians there at all. And these trucks would go into a distribution depot, be unloaded under the Dutch authority, although it was German occupied, This only lasted for a period of, I guess, maybe 3, 4, 5 days, but it was an extraordinary occurrence. The Germans realized they had to do it. So there was that period when the Germans relaxed their tension. And it was really a shocking period in their occupation, because the head of the German occupation was a thoroughly poisonous Austrian who had been appointed by Hitler as the Gauleiter of the Netherlands. Now I'll think of his name in a moment. He had been the man who greeted Hitler in Vienna when the Germans occupied Austria. He was the man who welcomed Hitler to Vienna in the name of Austria. His name was Seyss-Inquart, a thoroughly poisonous man. He was eventually executed, hung with the rest of the German group. But Seyss-Inquart was the guardian of Holland under the German auspices. And during the time he was there, he was an impossible person to deal with. I was there when General Foch's met with him, and General Eisenhower sent General Beadle Smith, who was his chief of staff, up to deal with Seyss-Inquart. You see, Eisenhower was, don't forget, was supreme commander over everything. And although Seyss-Inquart was a political figure, he was still to be dealt with by Eisenhower. There were no politicians in this at that stage. So Beadle Smith came up, and we met in a school. Seyss-Inquart came in. Prince Bernhard was part of our team, and we went up, he and General Foch and myself. And Seyss-Inquart came in with two or three of his military henchmen. And I always remember Beadle Smith's purpose in talking to him was to impress on him that the German military were not to blow the dikes in Holland. Holland is below sea level, as you probably know.
Yeah.
Or 4/5 of Holland is. The Germans were threatening, if we attack, to blow the dikes, in other words, to drown Holland, which would have set them back from agriculturally for 10 to 20 years. So Beadle Smith, in his discussions with Seyss-Inquart, was very pointed. He said, "You will not blow the dikes," and so on. And this was a "you will not." You know, we had reached that stage when we were telling him what to do and what not to do. And on one occasion, Beadle Smith said to him, "You will do this, that, or the other." And Seyss-Inquart said, "I would rather die." And Beadle Smith came right back and said, "You will." It was, I'll never forget that. It was just, "You will." And he did, of course. He died. He was strung up in a rope with the rest of them. But from the German point of view, he was a bad influence on the military. Seyss-Inquart then fled Holland after meeting with us. He got into an E-boat, a fast E-boat, and then skidded around. Hitler had died. He then went around on one of these very fast, and the Germans had very, very fast E-boats, and came in at somewhere in around Kiel, where he met up with Admiral Dönitz, who had been
the chief head of state.
Head of state, and I think that is where he was finally put in the bag. But he left behind him a General Blaskowitz, who had commanded German troops in Poland. Very able commander. Blaskowitz commanded the German 88th Army in Holland, and his chief of staff was a fellow called Paul Reichelt. And we, after much froing and chewing of people, myself and others, we finally got the surrender terms arranged, and Blaskowitz came up with his chief of staff, Reichelt. I went in with Foch and with Prince Bernhard, and I think Gilbride was in on that one. I've forgotten for the moment whether he was or not. And the signing took place in a school in a little village in a small town called Wageningen in Holland. This was the official surrender. If I could go back for 1 second, I mentioned Blaskowitz. During the time when this rather unpleasant fellow, Seyss Inquart, was facing Beadle Smith, Seyss Inquart was trying to undermine the morale of the German generals by telling them, or he had obviously told them, that you are all war criminals, so you will all be shot without any trial. So during the period that Beadle Smith was in this small village, in the little village, in the school in Achterveld, where the first discussions took place, he asked Beadle Smith, was General Blaskowitz a war criminal? So Beadle Smith went personally on the phone, got onto his headquarters, Eisenhower's headquarters, down in Reims in France. We had arranged, literally, tied in the phone so they could talk for this particular meeting, and asked if he was, and they went away and checked, and they came back after about 20 minutes and said, no, he is not a war criminal. He is not on the list. So Beadle Smith was able to say, you are not a war criminal. And this relieved Blaskowitz, because I think he was a man who Hitler had, after his successes in Poland, Hitler had ordered him to destroy the Jews in Poland, and he'd refused. So he had been demoted and put to grass. He'd been almost under house arrest for 2 years, and was only reused again when Hitler had killed off all the other generals, and there were a damn few left, and Blaskowitz was brought out again. But he had missed all the Russian campaign. He'd allowed no part in it, and had been in disfavor. And because of this, I think Blaskowitz felt that he had been a fairly honorable soldier. So when he was told, you are not a war criminal, this frankly lifted a cloud off his mind. The tragedy was that the 3 days afterwards, the Russians declared him a war criminal. And unfortunately, in those days, anything the Russians said went. And I've never been so humiliated, was the word, to tell the man that we sent him to Canadian Army. I went to his headquarters. We accepted his documents in his headquarters. I showed him pictures of Belsen camp with all these poor people dying and dead of torture and malnutrition and so on. He wouldn't believe it, so we eventually arranged for a German officer to go with a photographer, and the next day he came back with pictures, and which we showed him again, and Blaskowitz just burst into tears. He was absolutely sobbing, and he was a strong man. Anyway, he then left 1st Canadian Corps and went to 1st Canadian Army, where General Kerr received him as an honorable person and gave him a tent and an orderly, a German orderly and a Canadian. The Canadian was there as a guard, but the German orderly was to look after him, and they treated him fairly well and gave him good food. And about 2 days afterwards, he was announced as a war criminal. He was then taken off at Russian insistence to a prison where he committed suicide 2 days afterwards. But his chief of staff, Paul Reichelt, was the person that I dealt with, and Paul Reichelt just was horrified to think that, having told a man that you're not a war criminal, that you are regarded by everybody as a good soldier who did his duty, period, and then to have it reversed and commit suicide, after all, he'd been his boss for a while. But Paul Reichelt, I got to know fairly well. And the interesting thing, Jim, about Paul Reichelt was he had a first-class staff. It was very small. The German staffs are always small. Orders issued were generally by word of mouth or accompanied by a very short, you will, etc. You will do this, bang, Adolf Hitler sign. And I remember Paul Reichert because I got on well with him, and when I finally said goodbye to him, I brought him into my caravan and we had a drink, and I said I was sorry that officially we were not supposed to communicate, but I wished him well. Meanwhile, I'd gotten a letter to his wife in Bavaria, whom he hadn't seen for 2 years. He hadn't had a letter from her, didn't know where the hell she was. And when he told me this, I asked him to write out a note, and I'm arranged that she got it. And the next time I saw him was in 1959 at the maneuvers, in NATO maneuvers in Germany. He was commanding a corps in the new German army, and sitting right in front of me. And General Hans Speidel, who was at that time commander-in-chief of all land forces in Europe, 1959, was sitting beside him, and I said good evening to Hans Speidel. And then I tapped Paul Reichelt on the shoulder and said, "Do you remember me?" And he turned around, and really it was almost, you went back to 1945, because he turned and he said, "My God!" And then said in German to Hans Speidel, he said, he was my opposite number in the capitulation. I always remember the Germans used the word capitulation instead of surrender. But he was a... I always remember these incidents of these senior German officers, because they both were Austrian. Well, Blaskowitz, I guess, was originally a Prussian. He was from Prussian. But a man with a very warm heart, and I'm very sorry indeed that the Americans allowed the Russians to condemn him without trial. I mean, this was the Russians in those days, anybody who commanded anything in the Polish campaign, or anybody who commanded anything in the Russian campaign, was a war criminal, whether you'd done anything or not. This was their theory. And frankly, I was bloody mad as an individual that this absurd ritual had gone through. And however,
who were the main proponents of this, the war criminal?
The Russians. The Russian named the most, there's no doubt about that.
Don't forget,
it was agreed at Casablanca that there would be no surrender, and that there would be fought to the end. Right to the end. And the trouble with the Russian was that, I only met at the meetings when Beadle Smith came up from Eisenhower's headquarters. He brought with him a Russian general, who I don't know if he'd ever been near a bullet in his life. I have no idea, but he was a big clot of a fellow who, frankly, might have farmed 5 acres sometime. I don't know, but he was not my idea of a good, aggressive type of person that we would normally associate with that rank. And he had with him the most beautiful blonde you could ever imagine, a girl of about 22, whom we were told was his secretary and his aide, and that she looked after him. Well, I felt sorry for her. I felt if that's all she had to do, what a pity that we didn't have people like that, because, you know, we were all about 31, 2, 3, and there was this rather boorish type of about 45. I went up to him, and in the way one normally did, the war had just finished, we were all congratulating each other on what we'd done. I said to this Russian, whose name I've forgotten, I would like to congratulate you and your army on the great achievements and so on. And this girl, who was an interpreter as well, said to me that the general appreciated your marks and said that they were well deserved. Now, nothing else, nothing from him about how well you've done, not a peep. It was just, thank you, but we deserve everything you say. So I moved away. I wasn't very impressed with him at all. He didn't really have much to say with anything. And I would suspect that what happened after the meeting with Beadle Smith, when Eisenhower's people said, no, he is not a war criminal, this son of a bitch went right back on the blower and said, look back up Blaskowitz. Where did he fight? Condemn him. And that's exactly what I'm sure it happened, because... certainly he was not on any American or British list. But it was a very sad period, because the German army was disintegrating, but it didn't disintegrate from a disciplinary point of view. And I think one of the things that you have to give him credit for was Paul Reichelt had a quite small staff in this underground headquarters. When we told him that he had to move, I think they had, say, say 80,000 soldiers, I think, about there, that they had to move in a very small period of about 4 days by one route, because instead of going out through the area that we've been fighting, where frankly they could have been maybe abused by the Dutch people, we turned them and made them walk all the way around the Zuider Zee, as it was then, the Zuider Zee, and right back there into North Germany. And it was on foot. They were not allowed to carry any. Every piece of baggage was inspected to see that they had no loot with them and so on. And they just took off. They had damn little food, but they had a discipline that that everybody remarked on. Then nobody broke ranks. Mind you, they were shot if they did. People were shot when we first went in, when one or two German people started to get a little, German soldiers, maybe it had a little bit too much schnapps or something, and they would start Heil Hitlering in all directions or trying to steal things. Their officers just shot them, absolutely, bingo. No, there's no fooling about it. The discipline was very strong. But there was an incident. There was a General Plocher, one of the divisions in this group that surrendered there was 6th Paradiv, which was an air. The Paradivs, Paradivisions, were generally had an Air Force Association. And one was commanded, this one, 6th Paradiv, by General Plocher, P-L-O-C-H-E-R, Plocher. And he was a stuffy-looking character, whoever there was one, but he was obviously a brave fellow. He wouldn't have survived. And he asked if he could make a final speech to his division, a farewell. He commanded them for some while, and they had been very brave, and they were very brave soldiers. Well, General Fuchs agreed that they could do this, so we all said, all right, and off he went. And he wanted also, please, to say just one final Heil Hitler. So this is given, this is granted. And we had a British officer with us who knew all these people from pre-war. I think he'd been a military attaché or something in Berlin. So he knew the atmosphere and so on. And I've forgotten his name, Maynell, I think. But he was also an official interpreter. And we had, of course, a Canadian. And they went off with him, and Plocher got his people together. He only had about 3,000 in the whole division. And he got them into a field and spoke to them, told them how well they'd done and so on, and then finally he said, and from the time, from our final salute, you will be as good soldiers as you have been in peace, as you have been in war. There will be no breakdown in discipline. You will march as you're ordered by the Canadians and so on. And then he said, and one final salute, Heil Hitler, and the whole goddamn field rang out for the Heil Hitler, and that was the only thing that happened. There was no recrimination, no nothing. And they marched out with good discipline. I think we'd have been damn stupid had we said, don't do it. Because he would have done it in defiance, you know, and then he would have told them he was doing it in defiance. As it was, he said that he'd been permitted to say this. I think this set up a fairly good tone. But they were bloody good soldiers, and they had a... I think the average feeling of the Canadian soldier at the end of the Holland campaign was, if we ever have another one, for Christ's sake, let's have them on our side. They're far too good to be against us. This truly is a sort of epitaph that every Canadian would say.
Shortly after the war, you attended the War College in the States?
Yes, in Washington, National War College, 1947-48. In those days, they allowed 3 Canadian and 3 British officers, Navy, Army, Air Force, generally one of each, to attend for the 1-year course. And it was a secret arrangement, or confidential, if you like to call it. We didn't wear uniform. We had to wear civilian clothes. And we were, I think, officially attached to the State Department. And we were known as observers. This was an arrangement under the tripartite, the US, UK, Canadian tripartite arrangements of those days, which are very, very tight and very strong. And this lasted, unfortunately, for only 3 years. There were just 3 groups of us that went. After NATO became an entity, or during its discussion period, of course, France demanded an entry. And I think the Americans realized that...
French security.
French security to a degree, but if France did, you'd have to give it to everybody else. And so this wonderful arrangement of having us there died. But I, after a year or two, it was officially announced that we had been there. And I do have a certificate to show that I attended. But it was a wonderful course, and the interesting thing to me was, for the first time I met Americans who had fought in the Pacific, which is really their biggest theater,
right.
And had absolutely no knowledge, none whatsoever, of anything to do with Europe. None. They'd never heard of Nijmegen or the Trun Gap or Normandy. To them, Normandy was just like some island that they'd hopped over, you know, in the Pacific. Mm. It was just something. And these were all admirals and people who had fought there in high position. The staff were at the school were admirals and generals, General Lemnitzer, who subsequently became Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Grunther, who did exactly the same thing, and who could possibly, if General Eisenhower had not run for president, Al Grunther could well have been president. He was of that caliber. So, from the naval point of view, Admiral Hill was the commandant at the time, but under a student with me was Admiral Felt, who 4 years later was Commander-in-Chief Pacific during the sort of period of Korea leading up to Vietnam. They were all men of not all, about 10% went down, as it were. They weren't promoted. They had obviously a poor selection for the place. But it was a year's course, and during that year, we heard from President Truman, General George Marshall, everybody of importance in the capital, and from elsewhere too, came. And of course, the degree of security was very high. It was secret, top secret, so they could speak very frankly. Because of the fact it was an all-American audience except for the three or six so-called observers. And it was, again, as I say, to meet people who really had no knowledge of Europe, who had no knowledge of what Canada had done in the war, and it was nice to be able to talk to them and tell them what we had. At the same time, it was very nice to meet some of the people who'd been with Patton and Bradley, who during the war had such a low opinion of everything Canadian and British. And you know they did, there's no doubt. They were infected by Bradley's, infected by Patton's anti-British attitude. No doubt, no doubt at all. And to meet these people and just tell them what we did, for Christ's sake, when you people were running away or doing this, that, and the other, and achieving zero against nothing. We achieved a hell of a lot against 10 times what was against you. And it was interesting because we spoke frankly. There was no pulling any punches there. And I think we ended up with a very healthy respect for each other's point of view and each other's achievements, which is as a nation. It was it gave me an entree into the Pentagon, which at the end of my year there, I returned to Ottawa and was made head of plans. And plans in those days was planning with the United States, basically 70%, 30% with the UK. But this gave me a tremendous entree because I knew everybody who was in the business. And I would literally go from Ottawa almost once a week at one time to go down to try and arrange that if we didn't have something, if there was an emergency, they would supply it, or we could buy it, or that they would provide something if we didn't have it, or that we could maybe help them in giving equipment away. We had a lot of equipment then in Canada. We had enough. We had brought home enough for a force of about 6 divisions, 2 corps, which was a lot of equipment. And this was stocked and stored and incidentally damn well looked after. This would have, and did, when NATO started, of course, we gave away nearly every bit of this equipment to countries that had nothing. Turkey, France, Italy, Greece. We gave sort of two or three divisions worth of equipment, I think, to Greece and Turkey. And this really set us up. This was a credit to Canada that we could do this, that we had the equipment. To me it is of tremendous value, this particular course.
Well, the chief value was to get to know your opposite numbers and future senior officers of each Army.
Right. Indeed, yes, and Navy and Air Force too, because subsequently, one of the people who lectured to us was General Nostad, whom, 14 years later, I was in when he was Commander in Chief, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, I was reporting to him as the Canadian representative, the senior representative in Europe, and it was a tremendous help to go back over the friends we had, the mutual friends. The same, of course, in a way, with the British. If you know the people who are at the top, it helps tremendously in getting in. If they know you, and they know you're going to ask for something, at least they'll tell you when you get in there, George, don't even raise that question, for Christ's sake. We'll never give it to you. Let's have copies so you break, you don't even try. But no, I think the association with these people under those conditions, so that you're not in any way, you're one of a group, you're one of these days one talks about with your peers, you're not subordinate to them, you don't have to say yes sir and no sir and so on, and you just argue, you know, over a coffee or over a lyre dice or a game of cards or a drink, doesn't matter. Then that close association of a year, it stood me all through my service, all the way through. There was somebody I knew somewhere, and it helped Canada. This is the important thing.
Right. You mentioned General Norstad, and this would be jumping ahead a bit. Mm-hmm. He, I believe it was 1960, made a remark about Canada's contribution to NATO. Now, was that about the time that you would have been? Were you intimately connected, or what? I don't know if that's the right word, intimately, but was that when you were serving in NATO? That was 60, wasn't it?
I think it was a year or so after, wasn't it, when he came over and really hit the fan. I think I just left, if I remember. I think I left there in June 62, and if I remember, Larry Norstad came in October of 62 at the time. I think really his problem, and it was a problem that we had not paced up to, and it's in General Perk's book, the book about General Perk, it's well explained by Reg Roy, was the question of nuclear weapons. Mr. Diefenbaker, when he became Prime Minister, had gone to France in December of 1957, and he had signed an agreement, knowingly signed an agreement, that we agreed with the use of nuclear weapons in Europe. And all the heads of state or prime ministers, depending on which country it was, had signed this agreement, and Mr. Diefenbaker signed it. We then, the Air Force and then the Army, set about getting equipment that could use these weapons. Everybody else was getting them, and we felt we should have them. Certainly the Air Force, with their strike role in Europe, or their air defense role, needed to have the use of atomic weapons. Subsequently, they became a strike, and it was even more important that they have. After all, what the hell's a 50-pound bomb when you could drop a 5,000 tonner?
Right? For the same amount of.
Yes, for the same amount of energy and the same amount of waste of life, which is the important thing. From the, I think if you're going to really achieve something, maybe you don't mind dying quite so much, but to just to drop a canister of napalm and then turn around and go back and get shot up on the way back, you don't really feel you've achieved a hell of a lot. But the government, Diefenbaker's government, for years went on. Unfortunately, Howard Green, who was then External Affairs, was utterly devoted to peace. He could see no use, really, in armed forces. He could see no use in nuclear weapons or atomic weapons, except to bring on a Holocaust. And Howard Green, just all through all the discussions that I became involved in, and thank God there were not too many, was just a non-realist. He put his head firmly in the sand and said no. And John Diefenbaker, I think, had to be, after all, he'd been one of Diefenbaker's supporters, just as George Perks had. So you've got this awful business of Perks committed to them because he was Minister of Defense. He knew we had bought Bomarc Bs, which could only fire nuclear weapons. Diefenbaker knew this. This is the point. He knew it, but he didn't have the guts to finally say, we'll use them. And this is a tragedy from the armed forces' point of view. So Perks left. I don't know whether Diefenbaker felt that he had to push him somewhere else or move him, because he didn't want the confrontation with him. But he then puts Doug Harkness in. Doug had been a soldier with me, and a damn good one, and a very courageous individual. Doug Harkness, he never sort of gave in if he, on the question of principle. And he, after getting the normal briefings, having seen what happened from time to time, he just was equally convinced that you had to have the atomic warhead and the ability to use it. Well, of course, Diefenbaker accused him of being subservient to the generals. I think he's even gone publicly and said he was a slave of the generals, which is the most stupid thing you can ever say, I think. And so this was a very, very difficult period. So Norstad, all this time, we had in Europe, we had Honest Johns, which with our Canadian brigade, which would, had there been a problem, would have been probably one reason why the brigade could operate efficiently and would give it a chance to survive literally to survive. Right. They had the guns or the equipment, the launchers, but they didn't have the atomic warheads. And we were not allowed to make any agreement with the Americans that they could move and store them in our area. Although all the crews were trained on them, they knew exactly what to do. And the Air Force had much the same problem with their aircraft. And this just went on and on and on until finally, and I used to see Norstad only once a week, and he knew damn well it was not me. He knew it wasn't Folks. Folks couldn't do anything. Folks was there. And then subsequently, of course, Miller was made Chief of Defense Staff, and he could do nothing. This is entirely Diefenbaker and Howard Green. And really, the decision was never made by him. We just potted along, and it was part of his defeat in the end. One of the many, many things that Diefenbaker never made his mind up about. And so Larry Norstad went to Ottawa and just said, for Christ's sake, make your minds up. Do you want to be part of the team? You said you would. You signed in 57. And then you slowly opt out without saying you have. You're trying to weasel your way out, and you're not producing what you said you would. And he's quite right. There's no Christ.
He's still right.
Oh, it hit at a bad time, I think, from Diefenbaker's point of view. But Larry Norstad, after all, was the equivalent of a prime minister. And in the discussions in NATO, in the council, when he came in, he was only invited in occasionally when there was particularly a military problem, he spoke with the equal power of government, because his responsibility in the event of war or in the event of an emergency was far above any one government. He represented 12, 13 governments. And when he said fire, everybody fired. He wasn't going to go to governments and ask. All he needed was a presidential key to turn the lock once, and the whole damn thing would have gone off. He hadn't got time to go and appeal to governments. And he kept reminding the Canadian government, you can't pick up phones and say the Russians are coming when they've already gone through the back door and blown the hell out of, you know, the toilet and everything else in the rear. And no, I think Howard Green was a kind of a a non-realist in this. Howard was determined to have friends all through the world, and the only way you can get them is to lie down and let them kick you in the ass the whole time. That was his.
How much of a role does politics play in the senior or superior commands in the armed forces? For example, in appointments or in the nature of a policy decision.
Well, I don't. Don't forget, I retired in '65 before the Hellier
mess.
Although, as I think I mentioned to you much earlier on, I did support Hellier in his initial thinking about integration, that we should have an integrated staff at the top. Mm-hmm. I did support that. But his unification, one uniform, one rank, one and so on, was purely the ravings of a almost a lunatic who had assumed that he had great knowledge and great power. He had no knowledge, in fact, of the real elements of the military side, but he had great power, and this was a great tragedy. He had appeared to have a kind of a hold over Mike Pearson, in that he could threaten Mike with almost his integration in the Liberal Party if he didn't agree to his proposals. And I'd heard in 1960, 61, before the Liberals even came to power, that they were considering all sorts of dramatic changes in the military, but I never believed that anything quite like that would take place. But however, you asked about political interference. In Ottawa there is. Yes, there's bound to be. Of course, every time the military wants something, you're into the realm of finance, generally, into the realm of patronage, unfortunately, more and more right now, into the realm of really almost worse than patronage, of the awarding of contracts, to fool the public as to the value of the equipment being purchased. You buy 120 fighters, which are going to cost you $2 billion, and they work into this scheme that the military or that Canada is going to get $300 million worth of spare parts of this great deal.
Is that the C-5?
Well, in all of them. After all, every time the Americans produce something, we have to change it to a degree. That costs money. But this, the idea that you'd adopt an equipment, which is an American one, and then come back and say that with an agreement between the two governments, $400 million of this purchase will be spent in Canada. I don't know. To me, this is a very dishonest way of acquiring equipment. I think one should be. I think if you went to the Americans and said, "Look, put a plant up here, or buy a plant that's in existence and build whatever the equipments are that we require." You put up the money to buy the plant, build the equipment, and then get out. At least we would then have, you know, Canadair was really built that way initially. Canadair was basically an American company initially, set up a huge plant in Montreal, and then went into the production for the Canadian government of a variety of aircraft. Canadair did very well for Canada, for the States, and for the Air Force for a period of about 10 years. De Havilland tried this, and of course they were unfortunately owned by the British at this period. And when I say unfortunately, I don't mean this in a derogatory sense. It's just that the Brits didn't have the the money at that time to plow into this, into the development of de Havilland, although they owned it, in fact. No, I think it's a great pity. I think if they had, if somebody had, the Canadian government had said, all right, you can put a, whatever it is, $3 billion into de Havilland, produce 500 aircraft, we'll guarantee the sales of, and then you get out. In other words, you produce this great big thing for us and then leave. We'll take it over, or we'll arrange for a Canadian consortium to take it over. We would then be left with a tremendous plant, which is really what we wanted. But instead, unfortunately, in the case of, let's say, de Havilland, they produced what the Army call the flying truck, which has become the Caribou. They produced some superb aircraft that can almost take off on a dime. But they've never really had the finance, the money behind them, to launch into a huge program and get government support as well. They never have. Canadair always have. Canadair built the fighters. They built all the aircraft that really the Air Force has had for some years. A lot of people said that was Quebec influence. Maybe it was, but they got many more contracts. The only one that Toronto got, of course, was the one that was cancelled by the Diefenbaker government, and I think rightly cancelled. A fighter that's going to cost between $3 and $6 million a piece in 1958.
Was that the Arrow?
The Arrow. I mean, that was a monstrous... well, Hawker Siddeley had that contract, but it was cancelled. So, as you know, Hawker Siddeley almost pulled out of Canada from then on. They left a little. They left de Havilland, and they left... Render, I think, engines, and they left something else, but their main power, they just pulled right out. They just had no government support, so the hell with it. I think the government were right in cancelling the Arrow, frankly. But
as being too, basically being too expensive.
And nobody else would adopt it. This is the problem. You know, the Air Force has produced, or Canada's produced, some damn good aircraft. The Argus, which is a maritime reconnaissance aircraft. I remember in Europe in 57, 58, I had a little bit to do with trying to sell it to people. And everybody said, my God, it's a good aircraft. It's ahead of its time. It's this, that, and the other. But we have an industry of our own. And we've got to support it. The Brits had one in Belfast, so they had to keep